Today, we are looking at the social ecology of immune disease, a highly comprehensive white paper that proposes a shift from a purely defensive view of the immune system to an immune coherence model, integrating cellular biology with social and planetary ecologies.
It is an incredibly ambitious piece of work, a really massive scale.
It really is. But to maximize its impact on clinical and policy audiences, well, we need to dive right into our first critique, which focuses on tone and style.
Let's do it.
So the integration of philosophical terms like wu-wei and metanoic drift alongside rigorous biomedical concepts risks alienating the intended clinical and policy audiences.
Right, and we should probably unpack the biomedical side first because, I mean, the foundation the author has built here is just rock solid.
Oh, totally. It's incredibly thorough.
Yeah, they meticulously map out these nested ecologies and break immunity down into 7 operational domains, like sensing, context, tolerance, response, memory, resolution, and repair.
Which is a great framework.
Exactly. And the vocabulary they use to describe these domains is incredibly grounded. They use terms like DAMPs, which are, you know, damage-associated molecular patterns.
Right. For anyone listening who might not live in a lab, DAMPs are basically those chemical distress signals your cells send out when they're dying or under severe stress.
Yeah. And they also heavily feature SPMs, right? The specialized pro-resolving mediators.
I love that they focused on those because we usually just think about the immune system attacking a threat like a full-on assault.
The fortress model. Yeah.
Exactly. But SPMs are those specialized molecules that signal the system to stand down, clear out the debris, and, well, start repairing the tissue.
It's the biological breaks.
Yes. And the paper expertly weaves these very real, measurable mechanisms into concepts like epigenetic trained immunity. You read this and you think, wow, this person deeply understands the nuts and bolts of cellular biology.
It establishes massive credibility right out of the gate. You trust the author entirely.
You really do. But then, right in the middle of part 5, out of nowhere, they introduce the term wu-wei to describe an intervention hierarchy.
Yeah. That was a shift.
And later, in part 8, they start talking about metanoic civilizational drift. We suddenly veer off the road of hard science and crash into a completely different philosophical vernacular.
I hear you on wanting to keep it clinical, but, and let me just play devil's advocate for a second here.
Sure.
If we just strip out terms like wu-wei, don't we risk losing the entire philosophical soul of the paper?
Well, maybe, but...
Because the whole point of the piece is shifting our fundamental mindset, right? Wu-wei is this beautiful Taoist concept of effortless action, or, you know, non-forcing.
Right.
The author is using it to describe an immune system that doesn't violently overreact, which is what happens in autoimmune diseases. And it describes interventions that don't use unnecessary force. If we cut that, doesn't it just become another sterile medical text?
That is a really fair point. And I mean, the intent behind using wu-wei is actually brilliant. But we have to look at this through the eyes of the target audience.
The policymakers.
Exactly. Who is reading this white paper? It's a hospital administrator looking to redesign a care pathway. It's a public health director. It's a health minister deciding where to allocate a $50 million budget.
Right, and people looking for pragmatic solutions.
Yes, these people are scanning for institutional viability. If they see an esoteric philosophical term right next to clinical guidelines, there is a huge risk they'll experience cognitive whiplash.
Oh, for sure.
They might just dismiss the highly actionable concept of minimum sufficient care simply because the packaging feels a little too, I don't know, new age or theoretical for a board meeting.
Okay, when you frame it like that, I totally see the friction. A policymaker needs language that maps onto the frameworks they already use.
Like population health.
Right, or preventative care. We want to make it as easy as possible for them to say yes. So how do we actually fix this, rebalance this nomenclature without killing the author's voice?
So the core suggestion here is to rebalance the nomenclature by anchoring these philosophical concepts strictly in their biomedical translations, or simply streamline the vocabulary to maintain a consistent clinical and policy-oriented tone throughout the entire white paper.
Okay, so what does that look like in practice?
Well, one concrete example is to just drop the term wu-wei from the structural headings entirely. Instead of making it the main label, simply title Part V Minimum sufficient condition restoring care.
Ah, yeah, that is a highly descriptive medicalized phrase.
Exactly. It serves as a perfect structural anchor because a hospital administrator knows exactly what that means. It clearly communicates clinical value.
I like that a lot. But what if the author really strongly wishes to retain the cultural resonance of Wu Wei? Because it really is a perfect metaphor for immune tolerance.
Then they could use a call-out box.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. Instead of using it as the structural heading and primary label for the intervention hierarchy, introduce it as a brief, supporting analogy inside a dedicated call-out box.
So visually isolated, like a little sidebar that essentially says, hey, by the way, if you want a powerful philosophical parallel to this biological concept, look at this ancient idea.
Precisely. That way you preserve the author's voice, you keep the illuminating analogy, but you aren't demanding that a public health official adopt the terminology in their next budget review.
That is a fantastic compromise. It keeps the soul without sacrificing the utility. And I assume we need to apply that exact same logic to the later sections as well?
Absolutely. Like with metaconilic civilizational drift, I know they are trying to describe a massive shift in how humanity relates to the planet, but consider replacing it with phrasing like regenerative civilizational shift or systemic paradigm shift.
Oh, regenerative civilizational shift is really strong.
It works because it seamlessly aligns with the planetary health and One Health terminologies that the author already effectively uses in the appendices.
Right. Regenerative health is a huge buzzword that public health sectors are actively adopting right now.
Exactly. It directly connects the cellular repair mechanisms, like those SBMs we talked about earlier, with macro-level environmental repair. You are speaking their language.
Makes perfect sense. So, okay, we fix the vocabulary, we get the hospital administrator on board with the language, and they approve the framework.
Right. But words only go so far. If you're pitching this massive, multi-scale ecosystem to a doctor on the floor, they're going to say, great theory, but how do I actually use this? Which brings us to a huge operational gap in the material.
And you're talking about the AI tools here?
Exactly. The section on AI-augmented integrative understanding describes excellent high-level capabilities, but lacks a grounded, practical scenario demonstrating how a practitioner would actually interact with this technology.
Yeah, part six is, well, it's a bit abstract right now.
It really is. I mean, the author does a fantastic job emphasizing that AI should augment rather than replace human judgment.
The governance stuff is great. Yeah, they lay out strict governance and ethical guardrails, especially against using AI for mere surveillance, which is a very real concern.
A huge concern.
But then, it relies heavily on these abstract lists of capabilities, things like multimodal risk mapping, spatial multiomics, and digital twins.
And let's just pause on spatial multiomics for a second, because it's a very dense term.
Right. It's an incredible technology. For those who don't know, it's not just looking at a list of which genes are active in a patient. It's literally mapping where in the physical tissue those genes are firing.
It's like the difference between reading a grocery list and seeing exactly where the chef placed the ingredients on a plate.
Exactly. But because the framework asks practitioners to synthesize multi-scale data, ranging from that cellular signaling all the way up to planetary climate shifts, well, leaving the AI's actual interface and workflow to the imagination creates a big gap in understanding.
It really does. It is difficult for the reader to visualize how this massive amount of data is actively synthesized during a real-world patient encounter.
Right. Because if we look at it from the perspective of a clinician in a 15-minute consultation window...
Yeah, that 15-minute window is the reality.
You have 15 minutes. You are managing a clunky electronic health record system. You are dealing with an anxious patient, and you are trying to diagnose an acute symptom. If you tell that doctor an AI is going to integrate planetary biodiversity loss with their patient's gut microbiome right then and there, it sounds like science fiction.
Or an avalanche of new paperwork.
Exactly. You're asking a primary care doctor to act like a planetary ecologist in 15 minutes. That is a recipe for severe burnout.
So, is the connection between a spatial multiomics flag and a daily clinical workflow fully established in the material?
No, it's not. Which is why the suggestion here is to integrate a continuous narrative case study into the AI section.
that grounds the abstract technological capabilities in a localized real-world clinical workflow.
I see. So tell a story, essentially.
Exactly. For example, the author has a great vertical case study about asthma earlier in Part 4. They should extend that exact case study directly into Part 6.
Oh, carry it through. Yes. Show a specific scenario. A physician opens the AI dashboard for an asthma patient. Illustrate exactly how the AI flags an uptick in local particulate matter. That represents the planetary ecology layer.
Like smoke from a nearby wildfire or something.
Right. Then, show how it notes the patient's recent viral infection history, representing the life course ecology layer.
Okay.
And then, cross-reference this with a biomarker panel showing incomplete resolution at the cellular ecology level. By combining all three, the AI recommends a specific condition-restoring intervention.
So it's not just dumping a bunch of complex graphs on the doctor's lap.
Exactly. It synthesizes it into actionable advice.
Another concrete option, if the author wants to be even more direct, is to draft a mock AI output summary.
I love that idea. Like a text box.
Yeah, literally a text box demonstrating exactly how the AI would synthesize an answer to one of the author's immune coherence clinical questions from the appendix.
What would that look like?
Well, it could be a paragraph showing the AI identifying upstream danger burdens, like, say, local mold exposure based on the patient's housing sector.
Right.
And it shows the exact language the AI uses to deliver that insight without blaming the individual for their lifestyle. You show the actual output.
That mock text box is such a powerful tool because it proves the concept works in a real clinic. It takes it from abstract theory to an indispensable tool. But, you know, there is a catch here.
What's the catch?
An AI is only as good as the math feeding it. If we don't have quantifiable, standardized biological data, that beautiful dashboard is totally useless.
Oh, right. Because it has nothing to synthesize.
Exactly. Which brings the whole framework to a critical juncture and leads us to our third critique regarding significance and relevance.
The validation piece.
Right. The acknowledgement that immune coherence is not yet a validated clinical score is highly transparent. But the paper stops short of providing a strategic roadmap for achieving this vital validation.
The author is super honest about this, which is great. In Part 7, they rightly state that immune coherence should serve as an organizing logic for future biomarker development.
The transparency is refreshing.
But I wonder if we've considered looking at this from the perspective of a grant funding committee. Don't they need to see exactly how we plan to build these missing biomarkers?
They absolutely do. For a white paper aimed at driving a massive, systemic shift in healthcare funding, policy, and research, merely stating the need for future measurement is insufficient.
Right. Honesty won't secure a $50 million grant on its own.
Exactly. The document currently lacks a phased, actionable pathway showing how the scientific community gets from our current fragmented metrics to a unified, measurable immune coherence index.
It's like having a beautiful architectural rendering of a skyscraper. You see the glass, it looks gorgeous, but the grant committees are the structural engineers. They need the actual blueprints.
They need to know what materials we are using for the foundation.
Right. If the paper claims immune health is an achievement of social ecology, the immediate question is, well, how do we measure that mathematically? Without the how, it risks being categorized as a theoretical philosophy rather than an actionable scientific agenda.
And that is exactly why the suggestion here is to outline a distinct, phased validation roadmap that provides researchers, institutions, and funding bodies with a step-by-step guide on how to quantify and mathematically validate the immune coherence framework.
Okay, so write the grant proposal for the reader, essentially. What are some concrete examples of these phases?
Well, the author could start by proposing a phase one, retrospective validation step.
Retrospective, so looking backwards.
Right, where researchers are instructed to apply the 7 operational domains to existing longitudinal data sets. For example, analyzing whether historical data on DAMPs, combined with childhood infection history and housing quality, retroactively correlates with chronic disease outcomes.
Oh, that's smart, because retrospective validation is relatively low cost. You are using data that already exists. If the math works looking backwards, you validate the core hypothesis.
Exactly. And once that's proven, the roadmap moves to a phase two, prospective biomarker development step.
Building the new tools.
Yes. focusing explicitly on the framework's least measured domains. So, for example, the author could propose the development of standardized clinical assays for those specialized pro-resolving mediators, the SPMs, or maybe tests for macrophage efferocytosis capacity.
Because right now, you can't just order an SPM panel at your local clinic. It tells the scientific community, hey, we need to build these specific tools next.
It gives everyone their marching orders.
And what about the social metrics? How do we integrate those?
That's where a third concrete example comes in. The author could suggest establishing a coherence index consortium.
A consortium? Okay, as a specific policy lever.
Right.
A dedicated group whose goal is to standardize how qualitative social determinants, like housing and air quality, are mathematically weighted against quantitative molecular markers. By proposing a consortium, you provide a structural home for this future work.
It gives those ambitious policymakers a literal destination. Join this initiative to build the metrics.
It completely closes the gap between visionary theory and fundable science.
It anchors the highest level planetary concepts into measurable daily realities.
It really does.
So let's rapidly recap the main points of our critique today.
Sounds good.
First, we recommend streamlining the philosophical terminology, like Wu Wei, to maintain a cohesive biomedical tone for clinical policymakers.
Keep them focused on the science.
Exactly. Second, ground the AI section with a narrative case study to show exactly how multi-scale data influences a daily clinical workflow.
The asthma example.
Right. And third, add a phased, actionable roadmap for biomarker validation to guide future research and funding.
By tightening up these structural and tonal elements, this paper will be perfectly calibrated to drive the systemic change it envisions.
We highly encourage the author to implement these structural and tonal adjustments, and we invite you to submit your revised white paper back into the show for further review. We'd love to see where this goes.